Friends, good morning. Glad you're with us for another Sunday Online. And I'm taping this on Friday. It's a snow day. Boy, have I done a lot of shoveling. I can hear the snow blowers out there. I'm hoping you can hear them too. But snow day, oh my goodness, how about that, eh? Listen, before we get going though this morning, one quick announcement. Want to ask that maybe you'd put in your calendar Sunday, March 27th, because we are going to be hosting a Nexus family meeting, something leadership wants to bring to the entire community. So if you could mark that on your calendar, Sunday, March 27th. And of course, because things are always changing, we're not sure if this will be a Zoom family meeting or if we'll be in person. Who knows? That's still a ways away. But if you would get that in your calendar, we would love to hear from the community. More to come on that. But if you could just mark that in your calendars, that would be great. And we are now just, obviously not this Sunday, not next Sunday, two Sundays away from the beginning of Lent. And I've got some fun stuff planned for that as well. So I'm hoping you'll start sort of freeing up March to Easter there, which is in April, for doing some Lent stuff together. More information on that soon as well. But if you could kind of mark those in your calendar, that would be great. Sunday, March 27th, family meeting, and some Lent activities, which I'm hoping will involve movies and art and songs. So hold on to that. But back into Revelation we go for a final time. Well, at least for now. But just when I was beginning to think that dipping our toes into the book of Revelation might have been a mistake and not at all relevant to our current situation, wouldn't you believe what landed in my inbox this week? Somebody sent me an article from CBC entitled, "For Many Inside the Freedom Convoy, Faith Fuels the Resistance." And interesting article talking about how certain some people, the trucker convoy, right? There's a faith element there. But what really caught my attention was towards the end of the article, they're interviewing one guy about why he's there at the protest. And he went on to say this: "We live in the book of Revelation, 100%. If you look at what's happening, how the government is working, it is step by step all in the book of Revelation. It's as clear as day." Oh, oh my goodness. I had to sigh, of course, reading that again. Another situation where somebody thinks that Revelation is apparently predicting all of this, and how anyone can say Revelation is as clear as day. Now, that's beyond me, but I will say this. I do agree with him in a certain sense. We do live in the book of Revelation, just not in the way that I think he imagines. I would say this. I think we always live in the book of Revelation because, as we've seen over the past 2 weeks, we always have choices in front of us. We perpetually live with the choice of following the way of the Lamb or the way of the beast and empire and conflict and conquest, division, that or the way of the Lamb, the way of truth and self-sacrifice. And that choice is always in front of us. That battle is forever ongoing. Which side are we going to choose? And you know, this week for me was a bit of a week of despair, you could say. Although, what a highlight seeing a Canadian women's hockey team defeat the USA again for a gold medal. Wow, that was just spectacular. So that was a highlight. Grace, I know that probably didn't please you, but needless to say, that was the highlight of my week. But beyond that, it felt to me like a week of despair, like Super Bowl Sunday happened. I ate way too many chicken wings. And then the rest of the week, just looking what's going on in our country and around the world. And I just felt full of despair. And my despair this week, I believe, was something that the early Christians that John was writing to, they would have known particularly well, the feeling of despair. You see, John writes to seven churches, and many of these churches, they simply couldn't see a realistic way forward on the Jesus path. And for some of these churches John was writing to, all they had known since following the Jesus path was suffering and hardship as people of the way. They were discouraged. They were having a hard time making sense of their sufferings. And then for some of these other churches, they had essentially given up, given into the spirit of the age. What was the point they were thinking in resisting the impulses of empire? It was so powerful. Rome was so powerful. How could that be resisted in any way? They sort of lost track. They lost sight of the Jesus path in front of them, and who could blame them? I mean, Rome was ever present and powerful. What was the point? And it's to these struggling churches who could no longer see the path forward that John is writing to with these apocalyptic visions. And what John is trying to do is give these churches a vision, bombard their imagination, so that for these churches who felt like they lost track of the path, they lost track of the way, John steps in and says, here's what's in front of you. Here is the vision. You know, I think probably the greatest hike I have ever been on was when I visited Lewis Lodge ruins in southern Utah with my friend John. Now, my friend Riley was with me as well, but he decided to sit this one out, a little too strenuous. And this hike was amazing, but we found ourselves lost. You see, we pulled into this amazing campsite. We camped there for the night, and we knew that the next day we'd have to hike down the steep incline. And I had got directions off the internet. I had to pay money to find this place. Got these directions, and it said, you know, follow the trail down the steep incline, of course. And then when you hit an old farm post, take a right and follow the cairns, these little rock things that previous hikers have used that will show you how to get to the cliff edge to Lewis Lodge ruins and then scramble down the cliff in order to access the ruins. And so John and I set out, and we're hiking down this steep incline to get towards this particular canyon. And sure enough, there is the old farm post, right? Looking pretty worn down. We head right, and for the first little while, we were following these little just stone settings that big that were sort of guiding the way. But at one point, we completely lost track of them, and we were hiking, and we realized it had been about a half an hour since we had seen these little rock cairns sort of things. And we started to question ourselves, where are we lost? Have we lost the way? Have we lost the path for where we need to go? And we're getting close to this massive cliff ledge, and John's like, I don't know how to get down there. I don't know how we're gonna do this. We've lost our way. But we came to one section of the cliff, and there in front of us, we could see them. One sort of cliff down, we could see these remarkable cliff dwelling places. And I so badly wanted to get down to them. And we were looking for the way down. We just couldn't find it. And John's like, I think we've got to turn back. At least we saw them. But for me, I'm like, but the vision is there. I can see it right in front of me. I just don't know how to get down to them. The vision was visible to us, but the way had seemed to be lost to us. And John's vision in Revelation is something similar to what happened on my hike there. John's vision in Revelation is about this cosmic battle in another dimension between the beast of empire and lamb. But in the final two chapters of Revelation, John provides these churches with one final vision. And this vision is so breathtakingly beautiful to me that, to be honest, Revelation 21 and 22 are, to me, in times of despair, it's like finding a life preserver when you think you can't keep swimming. When the vision of the Jesus path seems lost or obscure to me, these chapters remind me of the grand vision. It reminds me of where we're headed on this Jesus path. And of course, like the rest of Revelation, it's cloaked in deeply symbolic language, and it's steeped in the history of the Hebrew people, right? So there's a lot of stuff to unpack there, but it's a vision especially, you could say, for people locked in despair, people who can no longer see the way forward. And the vision, as it plays out, it's like a tapestry of imagery from the Old Testament. John's pulling on all these sources from the Old Testament. But in particular, John is borrowing from and building on a vision of the prophet Ezekiel that had come centuries before. And of course, Ezekiel, the prophet, was around when Babylon had come through Israel and destroyed the temple in Jerusalem for the first time. They had carted the Hebrew people off as slaves. They were living in exile. And in that despair, God grants Ezekiel a vision of another temple that's coming. And it plays out this way in Ezekiel. The man brought me back to the entrance to the temple, and I saw water coming out from under the threshold of the temple towards the east. And as the man went eastward with a measuring line in his hand, he measured off 1,000 cubits, and then he led me through water that was ankle deep. He measured off 1,000 cubits and led me through water that was knee deep. He measured off 1,000 and led me through water that was up to the waist, then measured off 1,000, and now it was a river that I could not cross because the water had risen and was deep enough to swim in. A river that no one could cross. And he asked me, "Son of man, do you see this?" Then he led me back to the bank of the river. And when I arrived there, I saw a great number of trees on each side of the river. He said to me, "This water flows toward the eastern region and goes down into Arabay, where it enters the Dead Sea. And when it empties into the sea, the salty water there becomes fresh. Swarms of living creatures will live wherever the river flows. Fruit trees of all kinds will grow on both banks of the river. Their leaves will not wither, nor will their fruit fail. Every month they will bear fruit because the water from the sanctuary flows to them, and their fruit will serve for food and their leaves for healing." Now, this is something spectacular. Ezekiel's given this vision after the temple in Jerusalem has been destroyed the first time. It would be destroyed a second time around 70 AD. But this first time, and then he's given a vision of a mystical temple, you could say. And flowing from it is a stream of water. And at first, right, it's just a trickle. But as it flows, it becomes deeper and deeper and wider and wider. And this tiny stream from the temple, it flows into the desert. It becomes a river with trees suddenly springing up along its banks. And of course, these are no ordinary trees. They bear fruit every single month, and they have leaves with healing properties. And then, of course, when the river reaches the Dead Sea, the lifeless waters there are healed, and suddenly the Dead Sea is dead no more. It's teeming with life and fish. Everywhere this river flows, there is healing and life. And in the grand finale to Revelation, John's apocalypse, he borrows deeply from Ezekiel's mystical vision of a river of life with healing trees. And so after the battle of the beast and the lamb, John gives us in the final two chapters one final vision. One final time he's whisked away in the spirit, and it's a vision of a new society formed around the lamb that was slain. And it is called the New Jerusalem. And Jesus emerges at the center of this city to heal the nations. Now, it's lengthy, two chapters, so I've edited it down, but this is the expanded vision of what happens in John's final vision. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." And he who was seated on the throne said, "I am making everything new." And I did not see a temple in the city, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. And the city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and the Lamb is its lamp. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. On no day will its gates ever be shut, for there will be no night there. The glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. Nothing impure will ever enter into it, nor will anyone who does what is shameful or deceitful, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's book of life. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be any curse. And the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let the one who hears say, come. Let the one who is thirsty come. And let the one who wishes take the free gift of the water of life. I love this vision. For me, this vision nourishes and renews my faith in the hardest of times, in those weeks of despair. And it reminds me of the destination the Jesus path promises to take us to. And, you know, listen, I know it's often said the journey, life is a journey, right? Not a destination, or that a journey is more important than where you end up arriving. And I gotta say, I don't buy it. I mean, no doubt a journey is important and teaches us plenty. It's half the fun, you could say. But I would also say this, there is no journey without a destination in mind, right? I mean, further, the company we keep on a journey can make or break a trip, of course. But I don't know about you, I've been on enough road trips to think that anyone who says the destination doesn't matter maybe hasn't been on enough road trips. I mean, my friend Riley is notorious for his meanderings on our road trips, right? We're stopping at UFO centers when I've traveled with him. We're stopping at crocodile farms in the middle of Colorado. I mean, he has a penchant for little side trips on the way. And you know what? I kind of love them in hindsight. At the time, they're really annoying. But in hindsight, I love the exploration that happens on the way. But unless you have a destination worth traveling to, well, chances are we don't explore and learn from the journey. Unless you set out with a destination in mind, there's no journey to enjoy, to learn from. And so, yes, the journey is incredibly important. The company we keep on our journey on the Jesus path is incredibly important, but it's all dependent on the destination. The Jesus path purports strongly to have a very specific destination in mind. And of course, the Jesus path, the journey of the Jesus path, it teaches us that there are surprises to be found around every bend and corner in the journey. But what John's vision reveals to us here is that there's a destination. And this vision reveals to us the destination. Where are we heading on the Jesus path? Well, John reveals it in these two chapters. It is to arrive at the city of the Lamb, the new Jerusalem. And I want to make three observations about this city from John's vision that I think are important for us to always keep in mind. What exactly is the destination of the Jesus path? Well, first, I would say this. The destination is the new Jerusalem where we will find union. New Jerusalem, we're given this vision here, is vision of a marriage. It's the marriage, finally, at the end, the destination, the marriage of God and humankind. It's the marriage of heaven and earth. It's the marriage of garden and city. You've got Adam's lost garden and Abraham's longed-for city. They're united in matrimony, you could say, here in the New Jerusalem. And so the destination we're traveling toward is the New Jerusalem, and it's the promise of a marriage and union with God. And I know, because it kind of makes me a little uncomfortable, but I know that this might sound a little uncomfortable about this vision, but it needs to be said to fully drive home the point about our destination. This vision that John gives us here is very intentionally cloaked with sexual connotations. What we're talking about here is a marriage, a uniting, a coming together, a union. God and humankind are united as in a sexual union. Heaven and earth are united as in a sexual union. Garden, wilderness, city, they're united here as in a sexual union. And that imagery, I think, is very intentional. We're supposed to be calling to mind, you could say, both the intimacy and ecstasy of having sex, sexual union. The vision John gives us here is a destination that promises the orgasmic ecstasy of intimate union with God. And I get it. That imagery is a bit uncomfortable, a bit awkward for some of us, but again, John is trying to bombard our imaginations and he's calling on our imaginations, our minds, our feelings, calling to mind those greatest moments in life of union and ecstasy and intimacy. He's doing so to make a point. And then when you think about life, you take that word ecstasy, there may be a handful of things in life that can bring us moments of ecstasy, right? Maybe cuddling with your child, or maybe it's that lavish meal, good food and drink and laughter with friends. Maybe that brings us moments of ecstasy. Certainly music brings us moments of ecstasy, but perhaps more than any other comparable experience we know in life, sex is something we would both refer to as ecstatic and intimate. And I firmly believe that the ecstasies of having sex are intended for us to be a glimpse, a peek, an unveiling, as John would say, an unveiling. It's a momentary glimpse and unveiling of the ecstatic union we are promised to have with God at destination's end. And I suppose now would be a time for a personal anecdote, a story about sexual ecstasy, but I'm going to skip that one for this week. But this is the image we have here. It's cloaked in sexuality, ecstatic, intimate union with God. That is the destination of the Jesus path. But there's more. What is the destination of the Jesus path? Well, New Jerusalem, a city whose gates are never shut. The destination is the city of the Lamb, the city of union and marriage and ecstasy. But if you notice something very particular in John's description of this city, right? The city has 12 gates, but they're not for defense. These gates, he tells us, are never shut. And I find that gorgeous. The city gates are open on every side. And what this is telling us is this: entrance into this city is always a possibility. The city is pictured as one with gates that will never be shut. They're always open, always inviting in those who would turn their back on the way of the beast and empire, you could say, and simply come. And I hope that this vision is inspiring, particularly for, I think, many of us who grew up thinking that heaven was like a closed gate community. And if you didn't do the right things, whether it was saying a prayer or certain actions, you were going to be barred from entering this gate, this closed community. You were forever barred from entering. And John gives us this beautiful counter image. No, he says, the gates will never be shut. Entrance is always possible. And sure, if you want to remain outside, that's your prerogative. But the gates of this city of union and intimacy with God, they will never be closed. Always the invitation is there. Come. Anyone who is thirsty, come. Anyone who wants healing in life, come. Prodigal sons and daughters, you could say, will not have to suffer in self-imposed exile in some far-off country for eternity. Jesus reminds us in the story of the prodigal, right? The door to God's house is always open. The lamp is always burning. There's no security at the gate. It's simply open for anyone who wants to come. You might ask, I suppose, well, what about those? Do we have free will? I mean, what about those who don't want to come, who don't want to enter? I really like how Brad Jerzak envisions this future here. He says this: how will those with their cracked lips of sorrow and parched tongues of self-alienation respond to the hospitality of that all-merciful, forever-gushing spring? Their own thirst will lead them home, not begrudgingly, but by the free and desperate desire of heartsick love the moment they hear the Spirit and Bride call. And Abba shall run out of the gates at the first hint of their turning. While we're still a long way off, he will throw his arms around us and kiss us, robe us and heal with wine and oil, give us the waters of life and the feast of angels. Contrary to popular depictions of heaven and hell, the gates of this heavenly city, the gates of New Jerusalem, will never be closed. Finally, what is the destination we're walking to? So we're talking about some sort of mystical, ecstatic union with God. We've envisioned this city where people are always welcome. The gates are never shut. But final thing, the destination is the New Jerusalem, which brings healing. This is a city for the healing of the nations. We travel the Jesus path to ultimately end up at healing. And not just healing for ourselves personally, though that's important. God knows we all need that. But there's something much grander in mind here with this vision. It's the healing of us, sure, but also the healing of all nations. I mean, think about the deep divisions, the deep wounds of division we're experiencing here in Canada at the moment. And not only do we have the history of pain and injury and conflict with our First Nations people, but even at this moment during the pandemic, our country is deeply divided along a host of fracture lines. Our nation needs healing. Think about the deep divisions and wounds within the United States. That nation needs healing. Think about the Middle East. Think about Eastern Europe right now, or Africa, or Asia. I mean, you could pick virtually any nation around the world, and there exists within those nations deep histories of wounds and pain. Our nations need healing. And that's precisely the vision that John gives us here. That's where the Jesus path is heading. That is its promised destination. Healing of nations, healing of individuals, healing of our planet, healing. That is where we're headed. And you know, this vision, the vision of what citizenship in the New Jerusalem looks like is there within this vision, cloaked in symbolic language. But union, ecstatic, intimate union with God, a union of heaven and earth, a city whose gates will always be open and inviting, and a city whose river and trees offer healing. That's the vision. That's the invitation. Come. You can see it now. Come. But how do we get there? The vision is there, but it's, think back to my story again about Lewis Lodge. There we were, my friend John and I, and we can see it. We can see the vision in front of us. There are Lewis Lodge ruins. How do we get there? And John, of course, had said to me, I guess, well, we saw it. We didn't get to experience it, but we saw it. Maybe we should turn back. And I'm like, no, I know the instructions that I have. Tell me there's a way down. We just got to keep looking. And sure enough, step by step, took us probably 20 minutes hanging on the edge of a cliff, peering over, looking for a way down. But finally, John shouted out, I've got it. It's right below us. And peeking over the cliff, there was a small rock encampment that functioned as a staircase, taking us down to the next cliff layer. And we were able to reach our destination. What happens when what is visible to us, the vision that is visible to us, we can't seem to find a way to get there? I'm very keen on what Bono says in one of his songs, vision over visibility. Just because you can't see the way there, keep the vision in mind, keep walking, keep traveling, keep looking for it. So how do we get there? You know, we keep walking the Jesus path one step at a time. The vision of this new city, mystical union with God, a city whose gates are never shut, and of course the healing of individuals and nations and our planet, that's the vision, that's where we're going. But how do we get there when we can't seem to find the way? I think it's the same as my friend John and I hiking. Keep looking, keep moving, keep walking one step at a time. As I close, I might suggest this as a way forward, and it comes from Etty Hillesum. And I wasn't familiar with her until recently. She was a Dutch author of confessional letters and diaries, which describe both her religious awakening and the persecution of the Jewish people in Amsterdam during the German occupation of World War II. And in 1943, unfortunately, she was deported and then murdered in the Auschwitz concentration camp. But in the despair before she died, was murdered, in this despair of living in a world where she could see no way forward, where she could see no path that would take her beyond the beast and empire of Nazism, she concludes with this vision, right, of a better world. She concludes that the way forward might, in fact, be this. I see no alternative. Each of us must turn inward and destroy in ourselves all that we think we ought to destroy in others. And remember, every atom of hate we add to this world makes it more inhospitable. This, to me, is a wonderful vision. When we can't see the way forward beyond the beast of conflict and polarization and divisiveness that so marks our age, when we can't see a way past that, we keep in mind the vision of the New Jerusalem, the union with God, a city whose gates are never shut, a place where we are given the healing of the nations and planet. We keep that vision in mind, and we do what? We keep walking. Even when we can't see the way forward, we keep walking. And as Eddie reminds us, how do we do that? We turn inward. We destroy in ourselves the things we wish we could destroy in others, and we refuse to allow ourselves to add even a single atom of hate back into the universe. I know for me these days, that's a challenge I needed to hear, to rid myself of hate, to destroy in myself the things that I see in my enemies that I want destroyed. When we can't see the way, when we can't see the path, we keep in mind the vision and follow these words from Hillesum. I see no alternative. Each of us must turn inward and destroy in ourselves all that we think we ought to destroy in others. And remember that every atom of hate we add to this world makes it more inhospitable.